an important-looking letter from Berlin into her underpants, takes it home, and starts her evening fire with it. They come spilling into Etienne's kitchen with gleeful reports that someone has heard the garrison commander sneezing, or that the dog shit, placed on a brothel doorstep, reached the target of a German shoe bottom perfectly. Madame Manic pours sherry, or cider, or muscadet. Someone sits stationed by the door to serve as sentry. Small and stooped Madame Fontenot boasts that she tied up the switchboard at the chateau for an hour. Dowdy and strapping Madame Guibou says she helped her grandsons paint a stray dog the colors of the French flag and sent it running through the Place Chateaubriand. The women cackle, thrilled. "What can I do?" asks the ancient widow Madame Blanchard. "I want to do something." Madame Manic asks everyone to give Madame Blanchard their money. "You'll get it back," she says. "Don't worry. Now, Madame Blanchard, you've had beautiful handwriting all your life. Take this fountain pen of Master Etienne's. On every 5-franc note, I want you to write, 'Free France now.' No one can afford to destroy money, right? Once everyone has spent their bills, our little message will go out all over Brittany." The women clap. Madame Blanchard squeezes Madame Manic's hand and wheezes and blinks her glossy eyes in pleasure. Sometimes Etienne comes down grumbling, one shoe on, and the whole kitchen goes quiet while Madame Manic fixes his tea and sets it on a tray, and Etienne carries it back upstairs. Then the women start up again, scheming, gabbling. Madame Manic brushes Marie-Laure's hair in long, absent-minded strokes. 76 years old, she whispers, and I can still feel like this? Like a little girl with stars in my eyes. Diagnosis. The military doctor takes Sergeant Major von Rumpel's temperature, inflates the blood pressure cuff, examines his throat with a penlight. This very morning, von Rumpel inspected a 15th-century Davenport and supervised its installment into a rail car meant for Marshal Goering's hunting lodge. The private who had brought it to him described plundering the villa that they took it from. He called it shopping. The Davenport makes von Rumpel think of an 18th-century Dutch tobacco box, made out of brass and copper, and encrusted with tiny diamonds that he examined earlier this week, and the tobacco box sends his thoughts, as inexorably as gravity, back to the sea of flames. In his weaker moments, he imagines walking in some future hour between arcades of pillars in the great Führer Museum at Linz, his heels clacking smartly on the marble, twilight cascading through high windows. He sees 1,000 crystalline display cases, so clean they seem to float above the floor. Inside them wait the world's mineral treasures, harvested from every hole on the globe. Dioptase and topaz and amethyst and California rubellite. What was the phrase? Like stars flung off the brows of archangels. And in the very center of the gallery, a spotlight falls through the ceiling onto a pedestal. There, inside a glass cube, glows a small blue stone. The doctor asks von Rumpel to lower his trousers. Though the business of war has not let up for even a day, von Rumpel has been happy for months. His responsibilities are doubling. There are not, it turns out, a lot of Aryan diamond experts in the Reich. Just 3 weeks ago, outside a tiny sun-streaked station west of Bratislava, he examined an envelope full of perfectly clear, well-faceted stones. Behind him rumbled a truck full of paintings wrapped in paper and packed in straw. The guards whispered that a Rembrandt was in there, and pieces of the famous altarpiece from Krakow. All being sent to a salt mine somewhere deep beneath the Austrian village of Altaussee, where a mile-long tunnel drops into a glittering arcade filled with shelving 3 stories high, upon which the high command is stacking Europe's finest art. They will assemble everything under one unassailable roof, a temple to the human endeavor. Visitors will marvel at it for 1,000 years. The doctor probes his groin. No pain?
None.
Nor here?
None.
It would have been too much to hope for names from the lapidary in Paris. DuPont, after all, would not have known who had been given the replicas of the diamond. He had no insight into the last-second safeguards of the museum. But DuPont was of service nonetheless. Von Rumpel needed a number, and he got it. 3. The doctor says, "You may dress," and washes his hands at a sink. In the 2 months leading up to the invasion of France, DuPont fashioned 3 replicas for the museum. Did he use the real diamond to make them? He used a casting. He never saw the real diamond. Von Rumpel believed him. 3 replicas, plus the real stone. Somewhere on this planet among its sextillion grains of sand. 4 stones, one of them in the basement of the museum, locked in a safe, 3 more to find. There are moments when Von Rumpel feels impatience rising in him like bile, but he forces himself to swallow it back. It will come. He buckles his belt. The doctor says, "We need to take a biopsy. You will want to telephone your wife." Weakest, number 3. The scales of cruelty tip. Maybe Bastian exacts some final vendetta. Maybe Frederick goes looking for his only way out. All Werner knows for certain is that one April morning he wakes to find 3 inches of slush on the ground, and Frederick not in his bunk. He does not show at breakfast, or poetics, or morning field exercises. Each story Werner hears contains its own flaws and contradictions, as though the truth is a machine whose gears are not meshing. First he hears that a group of boys took Frederick out and set up torches in the snow, and told him to shoot the torches with his rifle to prove he had adequate eyesight. Then Werner hears they brought him charts for eye exams, and when he could not read them, they force-fed the charts to him. But what does the truth matter in this place? Werner imagines 20 boys closing over Frederick's body like rats. He sees the fat, gleaming face of the commandant, throat spilling out of his collar, reclined like a king on some high-backed oak throne, while blood slowly fills the floor, rises past his ankles, past his knees. Werner skips lunch and walks in a daze to the school's infirmary. He's risking detention, or worse. It's a sunny, bright noon, but his heart is being crushed slowly in a vice, and everything is slow and hypnotic, and he watches his arm work as it pulls open the door, as if he's peering through several feet of blue water. A single bed with blood in it. Blood on the pillow and on the sheets, and even on the enameled metal of the bed frame. Pink rags in a basin, half-unrolled bandage on the floor. The nurse bustles over and grimaces at Werner. Outside of the kitchens, she is the only woman at the school.
"Why so much blood?" he asks.
She sets 4 fingers across her lips, debating perhaps whether to tell him or pretend she does not know. Accusation or resignation or complicity.
"Where is he?"
"Leipzig. For surgery."
She touches a round white button on her uniform with what might be an inconveniently trembling finger. Otherwise, her manner is entirely stern.
"What happened?"
"Shouldn't you be at noontime meal?" Each time he blinks, he sees the men of his childhood. Laid-off miners drifting through back alleys. Men with hooks for fingers and vacuums for eyes. He sees Bastian, standing over a smoking river, snow falling all around him.
"Führer, Volk, Fatherland, steal your body, steal your soul."
"When will he be back?"
"Oh," she says, a soft enough word. She shakes her head. A blue soapbox on the table. Above it, a portrait of some foregone officer in a crumbling frame, some previous boy sent through this place to die.
"Cadet?"
Werner has to sit on the bed. The nurse's face seems to occupy multiple distances, a mask atop a mask atop a mask. What is Yuta doing at this exact moment? Wiping the nose of some wailing newborn, or collecting newspapers, or listening to presentations from army nurses, or darning another sock? Praying for him? Believing in him? He thinks, I will never be able to tell her about this. Dearest Marilor, the others in my cell are mostly kind. Some tell jokes. Here's one. Have you heard about the Wehrmacht exercise program? Yes, each morning you raise your hands above your head and leave them there. Ha ha. My angel has promised to deliver this letter for me at great risk. It is very safe and nice to be out of the Gasthaus for a bit. We are building a road now, and the work is good. My body is getting stronger. Today I saw an oak tree disguised as a chestnut tree. I think it's called a chestnut oak. I would like very much to ask some of the botanists in the gardens about it when we get home. I hope you and Madame and Etienne will keep sending things. They say we will be allowed to receive one parcel each, so something has to get through eventually. I doubt they would let me keep any tools, but it would be wonderful if they would. You would absolutely not believe how pretty it is here, ma chérie, and how far we are from danger. I am incredibly safe as safe can be. Your papa. Grotto. It's summer, and Marilor is sitting in the alcove behind the library with Madame Manic and Crazy Harold Bazin. Through his copper mask, through a mouthful of soup, Harold says, I want to show you something. He leads Marilor and Madame Manic down what Marilor thinks is the Rue de Boyer, though it could be the Rue Vincent de Gournay or the Rue des Hautes Salles. They reach the base of the ramparts and turn right, following a lane Marilor has not been on before. They descend two steps, pass through a curtain of hanging ivy, and Madame Manic says, Harold, please, what is this? The alley grows narrower and narrower until they must walk single file. The walls close on either side, and then they stop. Marilor can feel stone blocks mounting vertically on both sides to brush their shoulders. They seem to rise forever. If her father has built this alley into his model, her fingers have not discovered it yet. Harold rummages in his filthy trousers, breathing hard behind his mask. Where the wall of the ramparts should be, on their left, Marilor hears a lock give way. A gate creaks open. Watch your head, he says, and helps her through. They clamber down into a cramped, moist space that positively reeks of the sea. We're beneath the wall, 20 meters of granite on top of us. Madame says, Really, Harold, it's gloomy as a graveyard in here. But Marilor ventures a bit farther, the soles of her shoes slipping, the floor angling down, and then her shoes touch water. Feel this, says Harold Bazin, and crouches and brings her hand to a curved wall which is completely studded with snails. Hundreds of them. Thousands. So many, she whispers. I don't know why. Maybe because they're safe from gulls. Here, feel this. I'll turn it over. Hundreds of tiny, squirming hydraulic feet beneath a thorny, ridged top. A sea star. Blue mussels here. And here's a dead stone crab. Can you feel his claw? Oh, watch your head now. The surf breaks nearby. Water pearls past her shoes. Marilor wades forward. The floor of the room is sandy, the water barely ankle-deep. From what she can tell, it's a low grotto, maybe 4 yards long and half as wide, shaped like a loaf of bread. At the far end is a thick grate through which lustrous, clear sea wind washes. Her fingertips discover barnacles, weeds, 1,000 more snails. What is this place? Remember I told you about the dogs of the watch? A long time ago, city kennel keepers would keep mastiffs in here. Dogs as big as horses. At night, a curfew bell would ring, and the dogs would be let loose onto the beaches to eat any sailor who dared come ashore. Somewhere beneath those muscles is a stone with the date 1165 scratched into it.
But the water?
Even at the highest tides, it doesn't get more than waist deep. Back then, the tides might have been lower. We used to play in here as boys, me and your grandfather. Sometimes, your great-uncle, too. The tide flows past their feet. Everywhere, muscles click and sigh. She thinks of the wild old seamen who lived in this town, smugglers and pirates, sailing over the dark seas, winding their ships between 10,000 reefs. "Harold, we should go now," calls Madame Manic, her voice echoing. "This is no place for a young girl." Marie-Laure calls, "It's fine, Madame." Hermit crabs. Anemones sending out a tiny jet of seawater when she pokes them. Galaxies of snails. A story of life imminent in each. Finally, Madame Manic coaxes them out of the kennel, and Crazy Harold leads Marie-Laure back through the gate and locks it behind them. Before they reach the Place Broussais, Madame Manic walking out front, he taps Marie-Laure's shoulder. His whisper comes in her left ear. His breath smells like crushed insects.
"Could you find that place again, do you think?"
"I think so."
He puts something iron in her hand.
"Do you know what it is?"
Marie-Laure closes her fist.
"It's a key."
Intoxicated. Every day there is word of another victory, another advance. Russia collapses like an accordion. In October, the student body gathers around a big wireless to listen to the Führer declare Operation Typhoon. German companies plant flags miles from Moscow. Russia will be theirs. Werner is 15. A new boy sleeps in Frederick's bed. Sometimes at night, Werner sees Frederick when he is not there. His face appears over the edge of the upper bunk, or his silhouette presses binoculars to the windowpane. Frederick, who did not die but did not recover. Broken jaw, cracked skull, brain trauma. No one was punished, no one questioned. A blue automobile came to the school, and Frederick's mother got out and walked into the commandant's residence and emerged soon afterward, tilted against the weight of Frederick's duffel bag, looking very small. She climbed back into the car, and it drove away. Volkheimer is gone. There are stories that he has become a fearsome sergeant in the Wehrmacht, that he led a platoon into the last town on the road to Moscow, hacked off the fingers of dead Russians and smoked them in a pipe. The newest crop of cadets grow wild in their urgency to prove themselves. They sprint, shout, hurl themselves over obstacles. In field exercises, they play a game where 10 boys get red armbands and 10 get black. The game ends when one team has all 20. It seems to Werner as if all the boys around him are intoxicated, as if at every meal, the cadets fill their tin cups not with the cold, mineralized water of Schulpforte, but with a spirit that leaves them glazed and dazzled, as if they ward off a vast and inevitable tidal wave of anguish only by staying forever drunk on rigor and exercise and gleaming boot leather. The eyes of the most bullheaded boys radiate a shining determination. Every ounce of their attention has been trained to ferret out weakness. They study Werner with suspicion when he returns from Hauptmann's lab. They do not trust that he's an orphan, that he's often alone, that his accent carries a whisper of the French he learned as a child. "We are a volley of bullets," sing the newest cadets. "We are cannonballs. We are the tip of the sword." Werner thinks of home all the time. He misses the sound of rain on the zinc roof above his dormer, the feral energy of the orphans, the scratchy singing of Frau Elena as she rocks a baby in the parlor, the smell of the plant coming in under the dawn, the first reliable smell of every day. Mostly, he misses Jutta. Her loyalty, her obstinacy, the way she always seems to recognize what is right. Though in Werner's weaker moments, he resents those same qualities in his sister. Perhaps she's the impurity in him, the static in his signal that the bullies can sense. Perhaps she's the only thing keeping him from surrendering totally. If you have a sister back home, you're supposed to think of her as a pretty girl in a propaganda poster. Rosy-cheeked, brave, steadfast. She's whom you fight for, whom you die for. But Jutta? Jutta sends letters that the school censor blacks out almost completely. She asks questions that should not be asked. Only Werner's affiliation with Dr. Hauptmann, his privileged status as the favorite of the technical sciences professors, keeps him safe. A company in Berlin is producing their transceiver, and already some of their units are coming back from what Hauptmann calls the field, blown apart or burned or drowned in mud or defective. And Werner's job is to rebuild them while Hauptmann talks into his telephone or writes requisitions for replacement parts or spends whole fortnights away from the school. Weeks pass without a letter to Jutta. Werner writes four lines, a smattering of platitudes. I am fine. I am so busy. And hands it to the bunkmaster. Dread swamps him. You have minds, Bastian murmurs one evening in the refectory, each boy hunching almost imperceptibly farther over his food as the commandant's fingers grazes the back of his uniform. But minds are not to be trusted. Minds are always drifting toward ambiguity, towards questions, when what you really need is certainty, purpose, clarity. Do not trust your minds. Werner sits in the lab late at night, alone again, and trolls the frequencies on the Grundig tube radio that Volkheimer used to borrow from Hauptmann's office, searching for music, for echoes, for what, he is not sure. He sees circuits break apart and reform. He sees Frederick staring into his book of birds. He sees the furor of the mines at Solverein, the shunting cars, the banging locks, the trundling conveyors, smokestacks silting the sky day and night. He sees Jutta slashing back and forth with a lit torch as darkness encroaches from all sides. Wind presses against the walls of the lab. Wind, the commandant loves to remind them, that comes all the way from Russia. A Cossack wind. The wind of candle-eating barbarians with hogs' heads who will stop at nothing to drink the blood of German girls. Gorillas who must be wiped off the earth. Static. Static. Are you there? Finally, he shuts off the radio. Into the stillness come the voices of his masters, echoing from one side of his head while memory speaks from the other. Open your eyes and see what you can with them, before they close forever. The Blade and the Whelk. The Hotel Dieu dining room is big and somber and full of people talking about U-boats off Gibraltar and the inequities of currency exchange and four-stroke marine diesel engines. Madame Manick orders two bowls of chowder that she and Marie-Laure promptly finish. She says she does not know what to do next. Should they keep waiting? So she orders two more. At last, a man in rustling clothing sits down with them. You are sure your name is Madame Walter? Madame Manick says, You are sure your name is Renee? A pause. And her? My accomplice. She can tell if someone is lying just by hearing him speak. He laughs. They talk about the weather. Sea air exudes from the man's clothes, as if he has been blown here by a gale. While he talks, he makes ungainly movements and bumps the tables so that the spoons clatter in their bowls. Finally, he says, We admire your efforts, madame. The man, who calls himself René, starts talking extremely softly. Marie-Laure catches only phrases. look for special insignia on their license plates. WH for Army, WL for Air Force, WM for Navy. And you could note, or find someone who could, every vessel that comes in and out of the harbor. This information is very much in demand. Madame Manic is quiet. If more is said that Marie-Laure cannot overhear, if there is a pantomime going on between them, notes passed, stratagems agreed upon, she cannot say. Some level of accord is reached, and soon enough she and Madame Manic are back in the kitchen at number 4 Rue Vauborel. Madame Manic clatters around in the cellar and hauls up canning supplies. This very morning, she announces, she has managed to procure what might be the last 2 crates of peaches in France. She hums as she helps Marie-Laure with the peeler.
Madame?
Yes, Marie?
What is a pseudonym?
It is a fake name, an alternate name.
If I were to have one, what sort of name could I choose?
Well, says Madame Manic. She pits and quarters another peach. You can be anything. You could be the mermaid, if you like. Or Daisy? Violet?
How about the Whelk?
I think I would like to be the Whelk. The Whelk. That is an excellent pseudonym.
And you, Madame? What would you like to be?
Me? Madame Manic's knife pauses. Crickets sing in the cellar. I think I would like to be the Blade.
The Blade?
Yes. The perfume of peaches makes a bright ruddy cloud.
The Blade? Repeats Marie-Laure.
Then they both start laughing.
Dear Werner,
why don't you write? Censor marks.
The foundries run day and night, and the stacks never stop smoking, and it's been cold here, so everyone burns everything to stay warm. Sawdust, hard coal, soft coal, lime, garbage. War widows.
Censor marks.
And every day there are more. I'm working at the laundry with the twins, Hanna and Susanna and Claudia Förster. You remember her. We're mending tunics and trousers mostly. I'm getting better with the needles, so at least I'm not pricking myself all the time. Right now, I just finished my homework. Do you have homework? There are fabric shortages, and people bring in slipcovers, curtains, old coats. Anything that can be used, they say, must be used. Just like all of us here. Huh. I found this under your old cot. Seems like you could use it. Love, Jutta.
Inside the homemade envelope waits Werner's childhood notebook, his handwriting across the cover. Questions. Across its pages swarm boyhood drawings, inventions, an electric bed heater he wanted to build for Frau Elena, a bicycle with chains to drive both wheels.
Can magnets affect liquids? Why do boats float? Why do we feel dizzy when we spin?
A dozen empty pages at the back. Juvenile enough, presumably, to make it past the censor. Around him sounds the din of boots, clatter of rifles. Stocks on the ground, barrels against the wall. Grab cups off hooks, plates off racks. Queue up for boiled beef. Over him breaks a wave of homesickness so acute, he has to clamp his eyes. Alive Before You Die. Madame Manic goes into Etienne's study on the 5th floor. Marie-Laure listens on the stairs.
You could help, Madame says.
Someone, likely Madame, opens a window, and the bright air of the sea washes onto the landing, stirring everything. Etienne's curtains, his papers, his dust, Marie-Laure's longing for her father. Etienne says,
Please, madam, close the window.
They are rounding up blackout offenders. The window stays open. Marie-Laure creeps down another stair. How do you know whom they round up, Etienne?
A woman in Rennes was given 9 months in prison for naming one of her hogs Goebbels. Did you know that? A palm reader in Cancale was shot for predicting de Gaulle would return in the spring. Shot.
Those are only rumors, madame.
Madame Ebrard says that a Dinard man, a grandfather, Etienne, was given 2 years in prison for wearing the Cross of Lorraine under his collar. I heard they're going to turn the whole city into a big ammunition dump.
Her great-uncle laughs softly. It all sounds like something a sixth former would make up.
Every rumor carries a seed of truth, Etienne.
All of Etienne's adult life, Marie-Laure realizes, Madame Manic has tended his fears, skirted them, mitigated them. She creeps down one more stair. Madame Manic is saying,
"You know things, Etienne, about maps, tides, radios."
"It's already too dangerous, all those women in my house. People have eyes, madame."
"Who?"
"The perfumer, for one."
"Claude?"
she snorts. "Little Claude is too busy smelling himself."
"Claude is not so little anymore. Even I can see his family gets more than the others, more meat, more electricity, more butter. I know how such prizes are won."
"Then help us."
"I don't want to make trouble, madame."
"Isn't doing nothing a kind of troublemaking?"
"Doing nothing is doing nothing."
"Doing nothing is as good as collaborating."
The wind gusts. In Marie-Laure's mind, it shifts and gleams, draws needles and thorns in the air. Silver, then green, then silver again.
"I know ways," says Madame Manic.
"What ways?"
"Whom have you put your trust in? You have to trust someone sometime."
"If your same blood doesn't run in the arms and legs of the person you're next to, you can't trust anything. And even then, it's not a person you wish to fight, madame, it's a system. How do you fight a system?"
"You try."
"What would you have me do?"
"Dig out that old thing in the attic.
You used to know more about radios than anyone in town, anyone in Brittany, perhaps. They've taken all the receivers."
"Not all. People have hidden things everywhere. You'd only have to read numbers, is how I understand it. Numbers on strips of paper. Someone, I don't know who, maybe Harold Bazin, will bring them to Madame Ruel, and she'll collect them and bake the messages right into the bread, right into it."
She laughs. To Marie-Laure, her voice sounds 20 years younger.
"Harold Bazin? You are trusting Harold Bazin? You are cooking secret codes into bread?
What fat kraut is going to eat those awful loaves? They take all the good flour for themselves."
"We bring home the bread. You transmit the numbers, then we burn the piece of paper."
"This is ridiculous. You act like children."
"It's better than not acting at all. Think of your nephew. Think of Marie-Laure."
Curtains flap and papers rustle, and the two adults have a standoff in the study. Marie-Laure has crept so close to her great-uncle's doorway that she can touch the doorframe. Madame Manic says,
"Don't you want to be alive before you die?"
"Marie is almost 14 years old, madame. Not so young, not during war. 14-year-olds die the same as anybody else. But I want 14 to be young. I want..."
Marie-Laure scoots back up a step. Have they seen her? She thinks of the stone kennel crazy Harold Bazin led her to, the snails gathered in their multitudes. She thinks of the many times her father put her on his bicycle. She'd balance on the seat, and he would stand on the pedals, and they'd glide out into the roar of some Parisian boulevard. She'd hold his hips and bend her knees, and they'd fly between cars, down hills, through gauntlets of odor and noise and color. Etienne says,
"I'm going back to my book, madame." shouldn't you be preparing dinner? No out. In January 1942, Werner goes to Dr. Hauptmann in his glowing, firelit office, twice as warm as the rest of the castle, and asks to be sent home. The little doctor is sitting behind his big desk with an anemic-looking roasted bird on a dish in front of him. Quail or dove or grouse. Rolls of schematics on his right. His hounds splay on the rug before the fire. Werner stands with his cap in his hands. Hauptmann shuts his eyes and runs a fingertip across one eyebrow. Werner says, "I will work to pay the train fare, sir." The blue fretwork of veins in Hauptmann's forehead pulsates. He opens his eyes. "You?" The dogs look up as one, a three-headed hydra. "You who gets everything? Who comes here and listens to concerts and nibbles chocolates and warms yourself by the fire?" A shred of roasted bird dances on Hauptmann's cheek. Perhaps for the first time, Werner sees in his teacher's thinning blonde hair, in his black nostrils, in his small, almost elfin ears, something pitiless and inhuman, something determined only to survive. "Perhaps you believe you are somebody now? Somebody of importance?" Werner clenches his cap behind his back to keep his shoulders from quaking. "No, sir." Hauptmann folds his napkin. "You are an orphan, Fennig, with no allies. I can make you whatever I want to make you. A troublemaker? A criminal? An adult? I can send you to the front and make sure you are crouched in a trench in the ice until the Russians cut off your hands and feed them to you."
"Yes, sir."
"You will be given your orders when the school is ready to give you your orders, no sooner. We serve the Reich, Fennig. It does not serve us."
"Yes, sir."
"You will come to the lab tonight, as usual."
"Yes, sir."
"No more chocolates. No more special treatment." In the hall with the door shut behind him, Werner presses his forehead against the wall, and a vision of his father's last moments comes to him. The crushing press of the tunnels, the ceiling lowering, jaw pinned against the floor, skull splintering. "I cannot go home," he thinks. "And I cannot stay." The disappearance of Harold Bazin. Marie-Laure follows the odor of Madame Manic's soup through the Place aux Herbes, and holds the warm pot outside the alcove behind the library while Madame raps on the door. Madame says, "Where is Monsieur Bazin?"
"Must have moved on," says the librarian, though the doubt in his voice is only partially disguised.
"Where could Harold Bazin move to?"
"I'm not sure, Madame Manic, please, it's cold." The door closes. Madame Manic swears.
Marie-Laure thinks of Harold Bazin's stories. Lugubrious monsters made of sea foam, mermaids with fishy private parts, the romance of English sieges.
"He'll be back," says Madame Manic, as much to herself as to Marie-Laure. But the next morning, Harold Bazin is not back. Or the next. Only half the group attends the following meeting.
"Do they think he was helping us?" whispers Madame Ebrard. "Was he helping us? I thought he was carrying messages."
"What sort of messages?"
"It's getting too dangerous." Madame Manic paces. Marie-Laure can almost feel the heat of her frustration from across the room. "Leave, then," her voice smolders. "All of you."
"Don't be rash," says Madame Ruel. "We'll take a break, a week or two, wait for things to settle."
Harold Bazin, with his copper mask and boyish avidity, and his breath like crushed insects. "Where," Marie-Laure wonders, "do they take people? The Gasthaus her father was taken to?"
where they write letters home about wonderful food and mythical trees? The baker's wife claims they're sent to camps in the mountains. The grocer's wife says they're sent to nylon factories in Russia. It seems as likely to Murray Lord that the people just disappear. The soldiers throw a bag over whomever they want to remove, run electricity through him, and then that person is gone. Vanished. Expelled to some other world. The city, thinks Murray Lore, is slowly being remade into the model upstairs. Streets sucked empty one by one. Each time she steps outside, she becomes aware of all the windows above her. The quiet is fretful. Unnatural. It's what a mouse must feel, she thinks, as it steps from its hole into the open blades of a meadow, never knowing what shadow might come cruising above. Everything poisoned. New silk banners hang above the refectory tables, ablaze with slogans. They say, "Disgrace is not to fall, but to lie." They say, "Be slim and slender, as fast as a greyhound, as tough as leather, as hard as Krupp steel." Every few weeks, another instructor vanishes, sucked up into the engine of the war. New instructors, elderly townsmen of unreliable sobriety and disposition, are brought in. All of them, Werner notices, are in some way broken. They limp or are blind in one eye, or their faces are lopsided from strokes or the previous war. The cadets show less respect to the new instructors, who in turn have shorter tempers, and soon the school feels to Werner like a grenade with its pin pulled. Strange things start happening with the electricity. It goes out for 15 minutes, then surges. Clocks run fast. Light bulbs brighten, flare, and pop, and send a soft rain of glass falling into the corridors. Days of darkness ensue. The switches dead, the grid empty. The bunk rooms and showers become icy. For lighting, the caretaker resorts to torches and candles. All the gasoline is going to the war, and few cars come trundling through the school gates. Food is delivered by the same withered mule, its ribs showing as it drags its cart. More than once, Werner slices the sausage on his plate to find pink worms squirming inside. The uniforms of the new cadets are stiffer and cheaper than his own. No longer do they have access to live ammunition for marksmanship. Werner would not be surprised if Bastion started handing out rocks and sticks. And yet all the news is good. "We are at the gates to the Caucasus," proclaim Hauptmann's radio. "We have taken oil fields. We will take Svalbard. We move with astounding speed. 5,700 Russians killed, 45 Germans lost." Every 6 or 7 days, the same two pallid casualty assistance officers enter the refectory, and 400 faces go ashen from the effort of not turning to watch. The boys move only their eyes, only their thoughts, tracking in their minds the passage of the two officers as they move between tables, seeking out the next boy whose father has been killed. The cadet they stop behind often tries to pretend that he doesn't notice their presence. He puts his fork in his mouth and chews, and usually it is then that the taller officer, a sergeant, sets a hand on the boy's shoulders. The boy looks up at them with a mouth full and an unsteady face, and follows the officers out, and the big double oak door creaks shut, and the lunchroom slowly exhales and edges back to life. Reinhard Vollmann's father falls. Karl Westerholzer's father falls. Martin Burkhard's father falls. And Martin tells everybody, on the very same night his shoulder is tapped, that he is happy. "Doesn't everything," he says, "die at last and too soon? Who would not be honored to fall? To be a paving stone on the road to final victory?" Werner looks for uneasiness in Martin's eyes, but cannot find it. For Werner, doubts turn up regularly. Racial purity. Political purity. Bastion speaks to a horror of any sort of corruption, and yet Werner wonders in the dead of night, isn't life a kind of corruption? A child is born and the world sets in upon it, taking things from it, stuffing things into it. Each bite of food, each particle of light entering the eye. The body can never be pure. But this is what the Commandant insists upon. Why the Reich measures their noses, clocks their hair color. The entropy of a closed system never decreases. At night, Werner stares up at Frederick's bunk, the thin slats, the miserable stained mattress. Another new boy sleeps up there, Dieter Ferdinand, a small muscular kid from Frankfurt who does everything he is told with a terrifying ferocity. Someone coughs. Someone else moans. A train sounds its lonesome whistle somewhere out beyond the lakes. To the east, always the trains move to the east. Beyond the rims of the hills, they go to the huge trodden borderlands of the front. Even as he sleeps, the trains are moving. The catapults of history rattling past. Werner laces his boots and sings the songs and marches the marches, acting less out of duty than out of a time-worn desire to be dutiful. Bastian walks the rows of boys at their dinners. What's worse than death, boys? Some poor cadet is called to attention.
Cowardice!
Cowardice, agrees Bastian, and the boy sits while the commandant slogs forward, nodding to himself, pleased. Lately, the commandant speaks more and more intimately of the Führer, and the latest thing, prayers, petroleum, loyalty, that he requires. The Führer requires trustworthiness, electricity, boot leather. Werner is beginning to see, approaching his 16th birthday, that what the Führer really requires is boys. Great rows of them walking to the conveyor belt to climb on. Give up cream for the Führer. Sleep for the Führer. Aluminum for the Führer. Give up Reinhard Vollmann's father, and Karl Westerholzer's father, and Martin Burkhard's father. In March 1942, Dr. Hauptmann calls Werner into his office. Half-packed crates litter the floor. The hounds are nowhere to be seen. The little man paces, and it is not until Werner announces himself that Hauptmann stops. He looks as if he is slowly being engulfed by something beyond his control. I have been called to Berlin. They want me to continue my work there. Hauptmann lifts an hourglass from a shelf and sets it in a crate, and his pale, silver-tipped fingers hang in the air. It will be as you dreamed, sir. The best equipment, the best minds. That is all, says Dr. Hauptmann. Werner steps into the hall. Out on the snow-dusted quad, 30 first-formers jog in place, their breath showing in short-lived plumes. Chubby, slick-chinned, abominable Bastian yells something. He raises one short arm, and the boys turn on their heels, raise their rifles above their heads, and run faster in place, their knees flashing in the moonlight. Visitors. The electric bell rings at number 4 Rue Vaubereau. Etienne LeBlanc, Madame Manic, and Marie-Laure stop chewing at the same time, each thinking, they have found me out. The transmitter in the attic, the women in the kitchen, the 100 trips to the beach. Etienne says, you are expecting someone? Madame Manic says, no one. The women would come to the kitchen door. The bell rings again. All three go to the foyer. Madame Manic opens the door. French policemen. Two of them. They are there, they explain, at the request of the Natural History Museum in Paris. The jarring of their boot heels on the boards of the foyer seems loud enough to shatter the windows. The first one is eating something. An apple, Marie-Laure decides. The second smells of shaving balm and roasted meat, as if they have been feasting. All five, Etienne, Marie-Laure, Madame Manic, and the two men sit in the kitchen around the square table. The men refuse a bowl of stew. The first clears his throat. Right or wrong, he says.
He has been convicted of theft and conspiracy.
All prisoners, political or otherwise, says the second, are forced to do labor, even if they have not been sentenced to it.
The museum has written to wardens and prison directors all over Germany.
We do not yet know exactly which prison.
We believe it could be Bretonneux.
We're certain they did not hold a proper tribunal.
Etienne's voice comes spiraling up from beside Marie-Laure.
Is that a good prison? I mean, one of the better ones.
I'm afraid there are no good German prisons.
A truck passes in the street. The sea folds into the Plage de Mall 50 yards away. She thinks,
they just say words. And what are words but sounds these men shape out of breath,
weightless vapors they send into the air of the kitchen to dissipate and die.
She says, you've come all this way to tell us things we already know.
Madame Manic takes her hand. Etienne murmurs,
we did not know about this place called Bretonneux.
The first policeman says,
you told the museum he has managed to smuggle out 2 letters?
The second,
may we see them?
Off goes Etienne, content to believe that someone is on the job. Marie-Laure ought to be happy too, but something makes her suspicious. She remembers something her father said back in Paris, on the first night of the invasion as they waited for a train.
Everyone is looking out for himself.
The first policeman snaps flesh off his apple with his teeth.
Are they looking at her? To be so close to them makes her feel faint.
Etienne returns with both letters and she can hear the men passing the pages back and forth.
Did he speak of anything before he left?
Of any particular activities or errands we should be aware of?
Their French is good, very Parisian. But who knows where their loyalties lie?
If your same blood doesn't run in the arms and legs of the person you're next to, you can't trust anything.
Everything feels compressed and submarine to Marie-Laure just then, as if the 5 of them have been submerged into a murky aquarium overfull of fish, and their fins keep bumping as they shift about. She says,
my father is not a thief.
Madame Manic's hand squeezes hers.
Etienne says, he seemed concerned for his job. For his daughter, for France, of course. Who wouldn't be?
Mademoiselle, says the first man. He is talking directly to Marie-Laure.
Was there no specific thing he mentioned?
Nothing.
He had many keys at the museum.
He turned in his keys before he left.
May we look at whatever he brought here with him?
The second man adds,
his bag, perhaps. He took his rucksack with him, says Marie-Laure, when the director asked him to return.
May we look anyway?
Marie-Laure can feel the gravity in the room increase.
What do they hope to find?
She imagines the radio equipment high above her. Microphone, transceiver. All those dials and switches and cables.
Etienne says, you may.
They go into every room. 3rd floor, 4th, 5th. On the 6th, they stand in her grandfather's old bedroom and open the huge wardrobe with its heavy doors, and cross the hall and stand over the model of Saint-Malo in Marie-Laure's room, and whisper to each other, and then tromp back downstairs. They ask a total of 1 question. About 3 free French flags rolled up in a second-floor closet. Why does Etienne have them?
You put yourself in jeopardy keeping those, says the second policeman.
You would not want the authorities to think you are terrorists, says the first. People have been arrested for less.
Whether this is offered as a favor or a threat remains unclear.
Marie-Laure thinks, do they mean Papa?
The policemen finish their search and say goodnight with perfect politeness and leave. Madame Manic lights a cigarette. Marie-Laure's stew is cold. Etienne fumbles with the fireplace grate. He shoves the flags one after another into the fire.
No more. No more.
He says the second louder than the first.
Not here.
Madame Manic's voice. They have found nothing. There is nothing to find. The acrid smell of burning cotton fills the kitchen. Her great-uncle says,
You may do what you like with your life, madame. You have always been there for me, and I will try to be there for you. But you may no longer do these things in this house, and you may not do them with my great-niece.
To my dear sister Jutta, it is very difficult now. Even paper is hard to... Censor marks. We had... Censor marks. No heat in the... Censor marks. Frederick used to say there is no such thing as free will, and that every person's path is predetermined for him just like... Censor marks. And that my mistake was that I... Censor marks. Censor marks. Censor marks. Censor marks. I hope someday you can understand. Love to you, and Frau Elena too. Sieg Heil.
The Frog Cooks.
In the weeks to come, Madame Manic is perfectly cordial. She walks with Marie-Laure to the beach most mornings, takes her to the market. But she seems absent, asking how Marie-Laure and Etienne are doing with perfect courtesy, saying good morning as if they are strangers. Often she disappears for half a day. Marie-Laure's afternoons become longer, lonelier. One evening she sits at the kitchen table while her great-uncle reads aloud. The vitality which the snail's eggs possess surpasses belief. We have seen certain species frozen in solid blocks of ice and yet regain their activity when subjected to the influences of warmth. Etienne pauses. We should make supper. It doesn't appear that Madame will be back tonight. Neither of them moves. He reads another page. They have been kept for years in pillboxes, and yet on subjecting them to moisture have crawled about appearing as well as ever. The shell may be broken and even portions of it removed, and yet after a certain lapse of time the injured parts will be repaired by a deposition of shelly matter at the fractured parts.
There's hope yet for me, says Etienne and laughs, and Marie-Laure is reminded that her great-uncle was not always so fearful, that he had a life before this war, and before the last one too. That he was once a young man who dwelled in the world and loved it as she does.
Eventually, Madame Manic comes through the kitchen door and locks it behind her, and Etienne says good evening rather coldly, and after a moment Madame Manic says it back. Somewhere in the city, Germans are loading weapons or drinking brandy, and history has become some nightmare from which Marie-Laure desperately wishes she could wake. Madame Manic takes a pot from the hanging rack and fills it with water. Her knife falls through what sounds like potatoes, the blade striking the wooden cutting board beneath.
Please, madame, says Etienne. Allow me. You are exhausted.
But he does not get up. And Madame Manic keeps chopping potatoes, and when she is done, Marie-Laure hears her push a load of them into the water with the back of her knife. The tension in the room makes Marie-Laure feel dizzy, as if she can sense the planet rotating.
"Sink any U-boats today?" murmurs Etienne. "Blow up any German tanks?"
Madame Manic snaps open the door of the icebox. Marie-Laure can hear her rummage through a drawer. A match flares. A cigarette lights. Soon enough, a bowl of undercooked potatoes appears before Marie-Laure. She feels around the tabletop for a fork, but finds none.
"Do you know what happens, Etienne?" says Madame Manic from the other side of the kitchen. "When you drop a frog in a pot of boiling water?"
"You will tell us, I'm sure."
"It jumps out. But do you know what happens when you put the frog in a pot of cool water and then slowly bring it to a boil? You know what happens then?
Marie-Laure waits. The potatoes